Saturday, September 21st. The news of Europe. At this time, and each evening at 6:45 Eastern Daylight Time, Columbia calls in its correspondents in London, Berlin, and Washington for the latest developments at those points. Today we shall hear, too, from Albert Warner in our own nation's capital. But before hearing from our correspondent in London by transatlantic shortwave radio, here's a summary of important news from other points. In Hillsboro, California, there is still no word from the kidnapper who has taken 3-year-old Count Mark de Tristan, the heir to a copper fortune. The lad is being held for a $100,000 ransom, and the family is ready to pay the money. But so far, there is no report that the kidnapper has contacted the child's parents. In the Far East, it is reported that a crisis between French colonial officials and Japan has been averted. Japan had made a sudden and unexplained demand on Indochina and gave the colony until Sunday to accept. Now, word comes from Hanoi that Japan has modified its demands. And from Rome, there is still no indication of what Mussolini and Germany's Foreign Minister von Ribbentrop discussed. But the general belief is that Spain occupied a major part of the conferences. And now for the report direct from the British capital. We take you now to London. Go ahead, London.
Now, this is Larry Lester in London. In our 2 raids last night, the German raiders unloaded their bombs widespread over the city, and particularly in 2 districts. South London suffered heavily from firebombs, and a row of fires blazed south of the River Thames. Last night's raid was not remarkable against the series of raids which have preceded it, night after night, except for one thing. The Germans now seem to be using an extremely large type bomb, or one with terrific explosive force. These apparently do not waste explosive force by penetration into the earth, but explode on instant contact. 3 of these fell in the southwestern area of London last night, and virtually a whole street was wrecked. 10 people have already been removed from the ruins of the small dwelling houses, and rescue squads are still digging frantically. This morning's communique tells us that, quote, London was again the objective of last night's air raids, and very little activity was reported from other parts of the country. Reports received so far show that casualties were rather less than on previous nights, unquote. The anti-aircraft guns of London's defenses are not nearly so active as they were about a week ago. At that time, even windows in districts far removed from the guns rattled ceaselessly all night. The very air over London seemed to be churning. Recently, the anti-aircraft batteries have confined themselves to shooting directly at the raiders, and are not putting up a fixed barrage, or as some called it, a curtain of shrapnel. If the big barrage was put up to raise the morale of London's residents, I think it served its purpose. Even if the guns don't sound as often as they did last week, at least everyone knows that London has guns when she wants to use them. Some other old London marks were destroyed last night. On my way to the studio this morning, I passed the scattered windows of the barracks on Wimpole Street. One fine old church got it, too, last night. People, altar, and all. They say that 2 of the German raiders were shot down last night within 5 minutes. And some of us thought we heard the high-pitched drone of British fighters up above the double beat of the German bombers and the crack of anti-aircraft. Apparently, one of the reasons for relaxing the anti-aircraft barrage over London is to give British night fighters a chance to get at the bombers. In the daytime, the Germans seem to be intent on their program of sending over a few bombers, just enough to be a menace to London, and escorting these few bombers with perhaps 100 fighters. In this way, the Germans hope to wear down the British fighters, even if the British boys get 2 or 3 Germans before themselves get hit. Goering apparently thinks his numerical superiority will triumph by sheer weight of numbers. Goering, obviously, is also making full use of the air psychology he learned in the last war. When the German air chief was a member of Baron Richthofen's squadron, the plane of the great German air race was painted bright red, and it threw many a fright into Allied airmen when they saw whom they were up against. Now Goering has whole squadrons painted theatrically, Messerschmitts with yellow noses and Junkers dive bombers with yellow wings. It looks to me as though he'd like to throw a scare into many of the new pilots which the RAF is now training. You know, much of air fighting is psychological. And if a new pilot is worried about his opponent, half the battle is lost before it starts. I suppose the Messerschmitt pilots feel that way about Spitfires. They've heard so much about their speed and maneuverability. That's why the Germans are now beginning to use a lot of the new Heinkel fighters, which are as fast as Spitfires. A Royal Air Force pilot told me that the new Heinkels are very dangerous if you don't see them first, since they're so fast. But if you do, your Spitfire or Hurricane can outmaneuver them. Just as happened many times in the last war, a change in air superiority may be in the offing so far as quality of planes is concerned if the Germans have enough of these new Heinkel fighters. On the other hand, I happen to know that the Royal Air Force has a new fighter or two up its sleeve. One of them is called the Whirlwind, and it's supposed to be as fast and maneuverable as its name. I return you now to CBS in New York.
That was Larry Lesueur in London. And now for the report direct from the German capital. Go ahead, Berlin.
This is Berlin. The last military news we have is that German bombers attacked docks and other military objectives in London last night, says the DNB. Silver brick hits were scored in the Royal Albert Docks, claims this agency. And great detonations were heard. As for the British, we are told they tried to raid Hamburg and Berlin last night. Here in Berlin, it was quiet, and there was no air raid alarm. The Germans said to tell us the British bombers were driven off before they reached these two cities, both by pursuit ships and by anti-aircraft fire. The other British planes succeeded in reaching central Germany, but there again, when they reached the Hanover area, the DNB reports, and I quote, "When German fighters took off from their bases, the British planes turned tail," end of quote. So far, we have found no reference in either the German press or radio news of the reported heavy British attacks on the Channel ports, where the Germans are also reported assembling troops and supplies for the possible invasion of England. However, this morning, the newspapers are making a great to-do about the reports of the British bombing of Heidelberg, the historic university city on the Neckar River, and the city of Bruxau. At Heidelberg, we're told, a workers' home was hit and three were killed, while at Bruxau, a castle was damaged, and a church and a hospital were also hit. All of this makes further material for the German press and radio in their, quote, reprisal warfare incurred against England. For instance, the base out on Littard carries this headline this morning, quote, "The last appeal before annihilation," and it adds, "This people of parrots must be chastised like criminals," end of quote. Then on a front page editorial, the Solfer Blatt adds its anatomical threat to the British, stating, quote, "No bones will be safe in the bodies of these murdering rascals when the time of reckoning comes," end of quote. The other day I was talking to a German newspaper man, discussing with him German war propaganda, its constant identification of the British as the criminals of this war, and repeated threats of reprisal warfare. But he cut me short when I attempted to criticize some aspects of German war reportage. "Listen," he said, "always remember that this is total warfare. And when I say total, I mean total in all its aspects, press as well as military." And against that viewpoint, I could not concur the argument or even stop it again. I have one concrete news here about the winning conversations between Signor Mussolini and Herr von Ribbentrop. In fact, most of the German papers explain to their readers that due to the war situation, no details can be given regarding these important meetings. However, the Bulletin Zeitung adds that Rome and Berlin are in complete harmony, and, quote, "the enemy will learn in due time of the results of the decisions taken," end of quote. Serrano Osuna, the Spanish Minister of the Interior, has left Berlin for a visit to Brussels. He may return here when Herr von Ribbentrop comes back to Berlin to receive a report of these conferences. Incidentally, the other night when Signor Sunier and his suite were leaving the Hotel Adlon for some diplomatic function, along with their German escorts, the band in the lobby struck up what the orchestra leader may have considered an appropriate selection. It was an old American hit tune of some years ago, titled, "A Little Spanish Town Was On a Night Like This." This morning, the Foreign Office has issued a flat denial to the rumors that Signor Sunier is there on a peace mission. And there's some interest attached to a story appearing in yesterday's Warschauer Zeitung, the German paper in Warsaw. It reports that General Franco is building an army of 400,000 men. The Spanish leader has issued a new decree covering recruiting. By the terms of this decree, the paper explains, all Spanish men will be liable for 2 years military service and must have had previous military experience. The object of this recruiting decree is to raise an army of 24 divisions, which will be composed in the main of 61 infantry regiments, 10 machine gun regiments, 20 artillery regiments, and 3 regiments of armored cars. The German shortwave and press this morning explains the English have instituted a strict censorship with certain allow American correspondents in London to give many of the actual details of the German bombing of London and its military objectives. This is Edwin Hartwich, a returning now to Columbia in New York.
Back in New York, a dispatch from Alexandria, Egypt. Italian planes soared over Alexandria early today in a raid on the British fleet, but their bombs were reported to have fallen harmlessly into the sea. Naval anti-aircraft guns and coastal defenses forced the planes out to sea after a 45-minute alarm. For the report of Albert Warner in our nation's capital, we take you now to Washington.
President Roosevelt has arranged the details and is on the verge of announcing a new plan for the prompt development of water power from the St. Lawrence River. It can be disclosed now that in the name of national defense, the president has negotiated with Canada a program to lay aside temporarily the ambitious $500 million project for both a waterway from the ocean to the Great Lakes and power development. Instead, the present plan is to provide quickly for power only. While the long-delayed treaty for the older double project is sidetracked, Mr. Roosevelt, in the next few days, will send a letter to Congress setting forth his plan. At the same time, he will start to put it into effect with an executive order creating a study commission. That commission will be composed of Adolph Burley, Assistant Secretary of State, Leland Knowles, Chairman of the Federal Power Commission, a representative of the Army Engineers, and a representative of the New York State Power Authority. This commission will meet with a similar commission to be appointed by Canada to make a survey of the possibility of swift action in erecting a dam in the International Rapids section of the St. Lawrence. The president is expected to make available from his Emergency Defense Fund $1 million for the initial work covering the engineering plan and land acquisition. He apparently does not need to ask authority from Congress for this preliminary survey, but his letter to Congress will give full information as to the intended program. The president's aim is to have the power available for use by 1945. Now, some utility experts have been saying there is no great economic need for the dam. But according to studies made for the president, normal industrial expansion in the Northeast would absorb the power. Now, his experts say the requirements of a new war industry in Canada and a defense industry in the United States make action more imperative. Perhaps, too, there is, underneath and on the side, a bit of pleasure around the White House at the prospect of starting another public power project in a campaign in which the president's opponent, Wendell Willkie, is the man who led the fight against the management of a previous public power project, the TVA. In the Far East, Japan continues its pressure on French Indochina, although discussions there have been renewed. Confronted with Japan's steady expansion by force of arms, Great Britain, according to indication here, has now privately offered the United States a share in Singapore, Britain's naval base, last stronghold in the Far East. In the general conversations which have been held at the State Department, the spokesmen of Britain are understood to have let it be known they would be glad to have the American Navy make use of the base. Such an offer and its public acceptance might be another gesture to restrain Japan. Britain's Navy in the Far East has been cut to the bone. But for Washington, there is the strategic question of whether it wants any substantial part of the American Navy operating at that distance. There is also a question of foreign policy and of domestic policy. There's a strong body of opinion in Congress against taking on commitments in the Far East. If I had my way, for example, says Senator Lodge in Massachusetts, we'd get out of the Philippines. Geography should rule, he says. His attorney now to New York.
Columbia has brought you another broadcast in which its correspondents in European capitals and Washington reported on the latest developments. Mary Lasseur reported from London, Edwin Hartridge reported from Berlin, while Albert Warner was heard from Washington. George Bryan speaking. This is the Columbia Broadcasting System.